Welcome back to In Search of Black Power. This is part two of our conversation around the child welfare and the impacts it has on black families. So again, I want to throw it to Rasheem, so kick us off with part two.
Yeah, so we ended part one. If you haven't seen it, feel free to go back and watch it, but it's not necessarily required to engage in this conversation. It just is helpful in terms of providing context. One of the things that we left off with is having a discussion around not only poverty, but even more specifically, we were talking about why isn't this talked about a bit more, and particularly around in black feminist spaces, given the impact on black women, given the impact on black children, given the fact that we all tout that, of course, that black lives matter, right? One of the reasons that it is assumed or thought that maybe the conversation isn't broadly talked about in those spaces is because of class issue. Because the women that it impacts at a larger rate, the black women that it impacts at a larger rate, are at or below the poverty line. So with that being said, and having this discussion around black families being torn apart, having a discussion around poverty matters to start it off. And then we're going to get into some of the creative ways in which families are torn apart and interracial adoption and that sort of thing. So let's start first with the poverty conversation. So housing and security are among the main reasons why children are taken from their families and put in foster care, right? In stable housing. There's a prevalence of single mother families. And this affects women's poverty because women are disproportionately bear the weight of childbearing. And here's some stats to help with that conversation. So with the poverty rate at 23.3% in 2019, slightly higher than it was in 2000, Philadelphia is saddled with the distinction of being the poorest city in America. It is also one of the cities with the highest rate of youth in foster care. In 2018, black kids represented 14% of the youth in the U.S., but 23% of those that were in foster care. Getting more closer to home and Baltimore specifically, 33.3% of children in Baltimore City live below the poverty line. I'm going to say that one more time just because this is where I live. 33.3% of children in Baltimore City live below the poverty line. So that is $24,300 for a family of four in 2016. This is according to Maryland Alliance for the Poor in 2018. I say all that, and I'm going to encapsulate it with this quote by bell hooks in The Feminization of Poverty, and I think it also helps to even further bring home one of the points that Grand Prix was making in part one. She says, the most profound betrayal of feminist issues has been the lack of mass-based feminist protests challenging the government's assault on single mothers and dismantling of the welfare system. Privileged women, many of whom call themselves feminists, have simply turned away from the feminization of poverty. What comes up again, one of the other creative ways in which families are torn apart is through adoption. So there's the Adoption Safe Family Act. This was signed by Clinton in 1997, and this was an effort to be safe on crime. And the idea was that youth were languishing in foster care systems. So what we need to do is we need to free them so that they can be also, they need to be set free so that they could be adopted. So what this did, this act, is it sped up the termination of parental rights. It gave incentives to place youth at foster system, out of foster systems and into foster care. Now, there's a lot of cost and resources that are going into setting up something like this, right? The whole process of termination of parental rights, there's people involved, they receive coin for that process, for that administrative work. Mm-hmm. And then also those incentives that are given to foster system to place them in adoptive care, when if the issue with the family or with that is the challenge is lack of funds and resources, why not give that family, that single mother, that person, that parent, those funds that you would use to displace them from their family and instead speed up the disconnection of their own parental rights.
So you have foster care, which is oftentimes short-term, and adoption is, of course, the long-term. So you get money to foster kids because it's like, well, kids are expensive. We'll help you do it. And one of the things that people, like you said, it's like, well, if you give money to foster kids, how about you just give the money you give to the foster to the actual biological parent? And it's this weird truism, this tautology, where it's like, well, they've already proven they're unfit. But they're unfit because they're poor, usually. So you could give them money to make them not poor. That would make them fit. But it's like, no, we'll just send them to someone else and give them money. Mm-hmm. And this is overcoded with, and also just so people understand, again, from the policy perspective, the federal government will reimburse the state mm-hmm. if the person who is in the foster care system would have qualified for certain forms of federal assistance because they were poor. So if you're a state and you have poor people in your state and they're having trouble raising their kids, you got to pay for special ed. You got to pay for food banks. You got to pay for all of these social services. They're a drain on your state. But if you take that kid away from their biological parents and make them a foster kid, now I can go to the feds and hit the feds up for the money to support that. Mm-hmm. So they go from being a drain on my state coffers to being a cash cow for the state. So how we construct federal funding systems has a huge impact on how the systems actually function. As you stated before, a lot of this goes all the way back to the Social Security Act mm-hmm. passed in the 30s. So these complex interactions between the feds and the state have huge implications for how the violence flows against our families, which is why we wanted to do this podcast. But it's not just material. You know, lots of people on this channel are historical materialists and Marxists, and that's great. But we have to understand there's something going on here that isn't just material, isn't just dollars and cents. So if you think about this logic of being unfit, and you said it last time, you had this black family, they were holistic, they called their kid Amon-Ra, and they looked at that child and said that they were malnourished. Based upon that, and again, it wasn't just the fact that they were having trouble transitioning from breast milk to whole foods. It was the conceptualization of this black family. They didn't look like they were taking care of the child in the eyes of the people at the hospital. Think back to the MOVE bombing. Mm-hmm. And one of the arguments that the black social workers, the black middle class was making against MOVE in Philly in the 80s was that, look at those kids. They got dreadlocks. They run around the street. They dirty. Mm-hmm. So as opposed to seeing them as free-range children, which is all the rage in California mm-hmm. over the white families, right. You're seeing them as mistreated and neglected. And we know there are allegations of child abuse with MOVE. We know that's a complex situation. But again, juxtapose how MOVE was treated, oftentimes by black professionals, too, how white parents will do these similar things. You know, kids with dreadlocks running around dirty. They're seen as not just fit, but embracing, inculcating freedom into their child. And this gets to a story that I imagine a lot of people on this channel will already know, but in case you don't, the story of the Harts. So the Harts were this family of two white women married, and they were adopting black kids. And Miss Roberts talks about this in her book, so I'll just read it for you all. Again, this is a longer quote, but this is going to get into our conversation around why we as a black community have to talk about interracial adoption and the dangers of having, again, this incentive, this belief, potentially, that black children are better off with white parents. And that being a driver of family separation, not just the fact that state makes money by charging the feds for taking poor kids from their parents. Mm-hmm. So here's a quote. On March 26, 2018, Jennifer and Sarah Hart packed their six adopted children into the family's golden GMC Yukon SUV for a drive along the Pacific Coast Highway with Jen at the wheel. The white married couple had adopted two sets of black siblings after CPS took their children from their homes and placed them in foster care. Jen stopped at a gravel pullout, then accelerated towards a cliff, deliberately plunging the car onto the rocks 100 feet below. The two women and all six children, Marquise, 19, Huntal 16, Devon 15, Abigail 14, Jeremiah 14, and Sierra 12 perished. In their comments, the Hearts Devoted Facebook followers consistently referred to the woman and their adopted children as the perfect family. The couple convinced everyone that they had rescued their children, making the twin troops of virtuous white saviors and depraved black mothers. Jan claimed that Devontae was born with drugs pumping through his tiny body, in quotes, and by 4 years old had, quote unquote, handled guns, been shot at, and suffered severe abuse and neglect, end quote. Yet there were numerous signs that the children were being victimized by their adoptive mothers. In September 2008, 2 years after she was adopted, Hannah, 6, told a teacher that the bruises on her arm were from being whooped with a belt. After police investigated, the couple took Hannah and their two siblings out of school. 2 years later, when Abigail was 6 years old, she told her teacher that Jen had held her under cold water and hit her after accusing her for stealing a penny. It was Sarah who pleaded guilty to misdemeanor domestic assault, and the couple pulled their children out of school for good. CBS continued to receive calls reporting that the children were being denied food and subject to cruel punishment. One night, Hannah showed up on the house next door to the Hearts after escaping through a second floor window, pleading with her neighbors, "Don't make me go back. They're racist. They're abusing us." A photo Jen posted to Facebook of the three children dressed only in underpants sitting on the wood floor spread with newspapers. Each child was splattering colors onto a sheet of paper, mini Jackson Pollocks going to town. My mind, and this is Ms. Roberts writing this, immediately went to the television commercials seeking donations for relief agencies that show images of starving black children. I wonder if the white Facebook followers were so accustomed to those images that the painting scene reinforced their view of the Hearts as progressive saviors instead of raising concerns about their children's well-being. Another photograph Jen posted went viral, circulating on social media and television with a picture taken at 2014 Black Lives Matter protest in Portland, Oregon, of a black boy wearing a rust-colored leather jacket and sky blue fedora hugging a white police officer as tears streamed down the boy's face. That boy was Devontae Hart. And just so people know, this is hugely viral. In 2015, when Baltimore popped off, this is one of the images we sought to actively counteract with the images of the Baltimore protest, with this image in 2014. And that black child who was hugging that white cop got driven off a cliff by his white adoptive parents. Right, so to just finish up the quote here. Devontae's death is made all more tragic by the fact that his aunt, Priscilla Celestine, fought for more than 2 years to adopt him and his brother and sister before a Texas judge handed the children to the Hearts instead. Their mother, Sherry Davis, had lost custody of the children because of her drug addiction, and she and Clarence Celestine, the father of two of the children, relinquished their parental rights in 2006, expecting Clarissa's sister, Priscilla, to adopt the children. Priscilla, who had been caring for the children, had a clean record, steady job, a receptionist at a hotel, and a five-bedroom apartment, but she ran afoul of child welfare authorities when the caseworker discovered Sherry watching her children while the aunt was at work. Arriving unannounced, the caseworker grabbed the children on the spot, telling them to kiss their mother goodbye. That was the last time Sherry saw them. Despite multiple investigations and evidence of maltreatment, the Hearts were never separated from their adopted children. They repeatedly explained away their abuse by attributing the family's problems to defects. The children had a heritage from their mothers. Foster care compounds the lie that black parents are incapable of caring for their children, with the belief that black children are damaged and disposable.
We have to go back to that part, Grand Prix, of all of those opportunities to report, like the child themselves saying, they are abusing me, they are racist, no action taken. I feel like that needs to be highlighted and juxtaposed to situations wherein a mother's in a park and her child and her toddler is running. And she's telling them that that's my child. Or another person just calls and says, I don't think this child has eaten. Or this child just looks malnutritious.
Yeah, and again, it's like, this is part of why we have to think into the libidinal economy, the economy of pleasure and desire and emotion, not just political economy, like material money. There's something about black kids that white people feel they are entitled to them, that they have to save them because the black parents are somehow inherently pathological. There's a fear of black parents reproducing like black revolutionaries in their children. So it's better if white parents take them, teach them to love America, love whiteness, love the status quo, as opposed to them just the mere possibility of black people somehow injecting anger or bitterness or any political consciousness into their children, right? So there's just a fundamental belief. And unfortunately, again, many white women who call themselves feminists, who may be academics, again, there were academic battles that Dr. Roberts had to fight with high-level Harvard academics to basically prove that it wasn't just that black mothers were worse parents. That's why this whole disparity thing existed. And again, these are, it's just something very deep in the psychology of white Western thought that says that there's something dangerous about a black family being united. That it would be better somehow if we could inject and assure that the black child were somehow sutured to whiteness in some deep emotional, affective, material way. So this idea of interracial adoption, of course, is not just black kids. There's a huge legacy of interracial adoption in the Native American community. So this idea of interracial adoption as racialized social control doesn't start with black parents. It goes all the way back to kill the native, save the man, save the child, both Native American schools and separating them from their culture, from their reservations, and bringing them Christianity and turning them against their indigenous religions, their indigenous languages, and things like that. Many people have argued a very similar thing is happening with black kids and interracial adoption. But of course, we don't have a reservation. We don't have a formal separate language. We are in, we are an internal colony as opposed to a, an external colony with a legitimate claim to sovereignty. So this colonial relationship between black children and black parents and the white establishment hasn't been seen as formally as the colonial relationship between Native Americans, because they have their own like reservations and treaties and like sovereign law they can pull from. What we have is the political organizing in our community, which oftentimes is suturing us to the human social service sector, the foster industrial complex, rather than challenging it. So that's why it's important for us to draw out these distinctions so we can actually talk about these dynamics.
It would be interesting to know when it comes to transracial adoption, the percentage of other folks other than white folks adopting black kids, like how many black folks or Hispanic folks adopt white children? Just I would just be really curious about that.
Yeah, and we don't, I don't think that data was in the book, but with, what was in the book is that there's actually a slightly disproportionately low percentage of Latino children in the child protective services system, I think, because many of them are so far outside of the purview of surveillance, because you know, some of those folks are not legally on paper. So they're not part of the surveillance aperture.
Right.
If you're not legally on paper as you would be. And you know, those people aren't welcomed in a lot of those spaces, because in many communities, even if the majority of people are documented, from what I understand, the fact that a huge percentage are undocumented mean the whole community is going to be reticent to call CPS or call in those forces of the state, because by accident, as a ramification, you can lead to somebody getting deported, you know. But unfortunately, in our communities, the deep, deep prevalence of all of these spaces of surveillance, again, school, if you apply for food stamps, if you take your kids to the doctor, they're just, you know, just kind of another example is online school. Like the fact that they had to have their cameras on for digital schooling, they're using that as a mechanism to extend the family welfare system into people's homes. Because if you're on a Zoom call with your kid going to school, with school being digital for the pandemic, and they say, "Oh, your house look run down," you know, they can use that as justification to put you in that family surveillance system. You know, so there's just so many apertures of surveillance that lead to black kids being in the system. We have to raise that question of, unfortunately, we don't have the power to ensure that no, you know, racist white parent adopts a black child. But are there mechanisms of local accountability to the black community that can demand these systems, demand some accountability when incidences like this happen? I think that's kind of what we're trying to get to with some of the policy recommendations further on.
I know one of the things that that I read, and I'll read it here, that came up with the National Association of Black Social Workers. They came out in opposition to transracial adoption for two main reasons. One, the association claimed that transracial adoption prevents black children from forming strong racial identity. And it also prevents them from developing survival skills necessary to deal with a racist society, right? Mm. I don't think that those speak loud enough for the majority, the white majority, and in some cases the black majority, as reasons. But what stands out to me in the story that you shared is that even when there are like really significant big issues, it's not acted upon in a particular way that it should be.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have control over this system. And again, these are state-level systems that theoretically, like, we can have serious control over if we mm-hmm. organize locally to have control over those systems. But right now, they get a lot of their money from the federal government, so they're more accountable to the feds than they are to the local communities that they supposedly mm-hmm. serve. But that kind of gets me to another question, in addition to the interracial adoption question. And again, there's no way to stop it, unfortunately. We need mm-hmm. to organize to ensure there's some system for accountability and mandatory training. And also, we need to organize as our community to extend networks of kinship care. You know, as we said, black people have extended subjectivity. So why not just put those kids with not just a biological relative, but like someone in their community that might function as an extended subjectivity type relative, mm-hmm. extended kinship relative, a play cousin, things like that. You need to have money to foster, no pun intended, those networks of community care. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, they're going to take them to a white family that has inherited wealth. Mm-hmm. And they're going to say that makes the child more safe because you know that they're not going to starve because this family has a trust fund or a house they can sell or use the equity in the house that they own. You know, so mandating, to the extent possible, kinship care as a mm-hmm. first alternative before adoption, I think, is really important mm-hmm. to deal with this push towards interracial adoption. But that does get us to just something we should just talk about, which is Dr. Roberts is an abolitionist, right? She wants to abolish the system. And mm-hmm. she talks about it differently than other so-called abolitionists. Mm-hmm. But how do you deal with this whole idea of abolishing the family regulation system, the foster industrial complex, with the idea that there is very real harm happening to not just black children, but children of all races, mm-hmm. right? So how do you think about that in your mind?
I think one of the things that come up for me is some of what you said, just establishing a community of mutual aid, right? What strengths does the community have? What are the needs of that community? What is our mutual aid focus? What resources, what networks, friends and family, creating a plan for funding, and then taking action. It usually doesn't happen on that sort of level, but I feel like we do care for, we have always cared for and provided care in some like non-necessarily institutional ways and in some institutional ways, whether that has been something like the black church mm-hmm. or the black grandmother on the corner who's like, she's raising her kid, she's raising her daughter's kid, or I feel like there's informal ways that we are already doing that. It's just not professionalized, let's mm-hmm. say, or documented in a particular way for us to just say that we're going to take that model and perpetuate it. But I think that just having more mutual aid mm-hmm. Projects, so to speak, or more mutual aid communities are ways in which that we could do that.
Yeah. So I'm just going to take a small step back because I obviously agree with all of that. But if you're concerned with children and their safety, you have to understand just how terrible the current system is that is a vector of violence against children rather than a mechanism to protect them. I'm not going to go over all the horror stories within the foster care, you know, a group home situation, but here's just a few. You know, if you have a trans child or a gay child, they're often subject to extreme bullying and misgendering in these collective home situations. A Baltimore study said that you were more likely to be abused at one of these group homes than you actually were likely to be abused at home. Mm. Like the levels of abuse from the staff, abuse from other kids around you, the collective trauma being served out by being taken from your family is oftentimes in aggregate higher than the difficult, complex situations you might have at home, all things considered. There was one kid who was taken out of their home because the family was too poor and said the house was too small, and put into a foster care situation when they end up being locked in the closet, right? So you have systems, group homes, foster care systems, another example, high dependence on psychotropic medication. So there's a huge issue of people aging out of foster care and aging into addiction, because many times they've been primed to be pumped full of drugs from a very, very young age. You know, behavioral medication, bipolar medication, antidepressants, Ritalin, all of these things are part of the stock and trade of the foster care system. And if you actually look at, and you know, people like, you know, Casey Family Welfare Systems, there are nonprofits that have actually done pretty good work trying to talk about this. They actually did a study where they followed up with a percentage of people after they aged out of foster care. And 80% of them were not doing well. Mm-hmm. They were not financially stable. They were not dealing well with the emotional trauma ramifications of foster care. So just the basic question, is our system producing people who are healthy and recovering from the violence they faced as children? No. 80% of them were not doing well. Right.
I can't help but have this conversation in the context of recent abortion activity. Mm-hmm. Right, when we talk about care and being able to provide for and care for. And one of the main reasons that I've heard in terms of mothers deciding to not have a child or have another child, because in large cases, most of the women who decide to not have a child is they're already mothers, is because the impact, like economics, right? Mm-hmm. So if the reason that a mother is deciding I'm not going to have a child is because I cannot afford to have a child, then we say we are going to put mechanisms in place to make it difficult for you to not have a child. But then once you get this child, we are going to penalize you mm-hmm. because you are not able to afford to take care of these additional children that we have put barriers for you to not be able to have.
Mm-hmm. And while you're struggling to make money to take care of your kid, they take your kid away. The institutions that take your kid away are themselves often for-profit companies. Mm-hmm. So one of the largest operator of group homes used to be called National Mentor Holdings. They recently rebranded mm-hmm. to Civita. And if you can just look on the screen, like they're on the stock exchange. You can buy stock in the family separation, the family regulation industrial complex. And business is booming for these people. You know, they had an IPO of $628 million in 2014. Mm. Like, Civita should be like Halliburton. It should be completely toxic to even mention an entity that profits from the systemic destruction of Black families. But that's not where we are right now. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. we lack the sophistication in our analysis to be able to identify how these institutions are profiting, literally, like for-profit institutions off of our suffering.
I just wanted to highlight something from the Pediatrics Publication organization. And it looks like they did this study in 2012. And they used a logistical regression models for those who are statisticians out there. they found that for foster care youth, they were 7 times... more likely to experience depression, 6 times more likely to exhibit behavioral problems, 5 times more likely to feel anxiety, 3 times as likely to have attention deficit disorder, hearing impairments, and vision issues, and twice as likely to suffer from learning disabilities, developmental delays, mm-hmm. asthma, obesity, and speech problems. Mm. If we are a care system, why are we using this as a mechanism when it has so many things that are telling us that it's harming? It's doing more harm than good in a lot of cases.
Yeah, and again, this is a lot of people's anxieties about destroying what exists, is that they're scared about the violence that can be produced by not having anything in place. Now, we do have mechanisms in place that can be scaled up, obviously, to replace the system, but you have to understand just how bad the reality is in our current system. Mm-hmm. And I don't think traditional media has done a good job explaining mm-hmm. just the degree of, you know, again, if you're a social worker, if you are someone who has to work with people who age out of the foster care system, just the levels of psychological trauma and addiction. I mean, people fall out of foster care and enter into survival sex work. Mm. There's just so many different degrees of what you have to deal with in terms of really just a fallout of right. this failed system. And, you know, many times people just they get in trouble for going back to their families. Like, when you separate them from their family, don't just separate them from their family, you separate them from like, their extended care network.
Right.
Their friends, their play cousins. And people literally will sometimes leave their foster parents and go back to, like, their biological parents. Mm-hmm. Not, like, to stay, but, like, to try to reconnect to a sense of community they lost when they got separated. So are there mechanisms that can facilitate that cultural exchange between biological parent and foster parent when you do have to have a foster situation for whatever reason, right? As opposed to pathologizing that connection and sort of seeing it as a benefit to the child to fully sever them from their indigenous cultural communal context. So I wanted to kind of conclude with, and you know, I have probably more notes than I can get to, just a little bit of the policy work that has to happen for us to deal with some of these dynamics of funding and some of the reality of what's happening with, especially the Democratic Party. Because we got told over and over again, Jared, this is for you, in part, because people beat you over the head and tell us to vote Democrat because we got to get the Supreme Court in line. We got to get the federal judiciary. And if you look at family regulation, child welfare, it has been many times the Democrats that have sold us out on the Supreme Court. So we have to think beyond the Supreme Court for the solution to this problem, even before the Republican takeover. Look at, you know, you get certain benefits like Social Security if you are, like, you know, living with your grandmother. If you have to get taken from your grandmother, like, you're still entitled to some of those benefits as a foster child. What was happening was that the foster care system was literally stealing those benefits from the foster child to pay for foster care. Took it to the Supreme Court because that's wrong. And what was the Supreme Court decision in Washington versus Kefler? It was a unanimous decision in favor of allowing the foster care systems to take those benefits from those kids. So y'all's beloved Ruth Bader Ginsburg, y'all's beloved David Kennedy, y'all's beloved Souter, they all sold out these kids in foster care to allow their benefits to be stolen at a federal level. Now, some states, like Maryland, actually put some things in law to push back against that, but that was what happened at the Supreme Court level. When it comes to Native Americans, you know, interracial solidarity, Native sovereignty, there's a the Indian Child Welfare Act set a higher standard for the termination of parental rights and supposedly wanted to support Indian control of the healthcare system. But in a case called Adoptive Couple versus Baby Girl, Justice Breyer, a Democratic appointee, agreed to allow a white couple to terminate the parental rights and adopt one of these Indian children. So it struck a blow against Native sovereignty to vote with the conservative majority in that case of Adoptive Couple versus Baby Girl. Right. So this is the reality of being constantly browbeat into supposedly supporting Supreme Court nominations because of this assertion, certainty that Republicans are always evil, Democrats are always better. In the book, they actually talk about there are actual Republican lawmakers who tried to take on the child welfare systems in their own state and found out that even as Republicans, they were subject to backlash and attacks for trying to support parental rights because of the economic incentives in the industry, right? So if you look at things like the Indian Child Welfare Act, it has been criticized for not going far enough, for being racist, basically, for talking about Native rights. And what's happened, again, is that it wasn't funded. You didn't actually give Native Americans money to fully operate an autonomous child welfare system. So you can't look at the courts. You have to look at Congress because Congress has the power of the purse. They are the entity that can actually fund these alternative systems. So the last thing I wanted to talk about on the policy level was the Social Security Act. You have Social Security Title IV Part E, which is a lot of what they use, like block grants, to actually fund the foster care system. But you also have Part B, which is supposed to be preventative services, right? So what you have is Title E is an entitlement. It's mandatory funded every year. Title B, the preventative stuff, the stuff we want, is discretionary. They can take it in and out of the budget every year however they want, right? So a potential reform, not saying for sure, potential reform is making Title B funding have parity with Title E, making a mandatory yearly allotment that match, or at least to some percentage, match the percentage for Title E. And these are the sort of policy machinations that our opponents use all the time to figure out how they want to screw us over. But we oftentimes, when we do policy, it has to be everything. It has to be universal basic income. It has to be global health care for everybody right now autonomously. It has to be a job guarantee. But it's sometimes these sort of very complex technocratic decisions that can determine whether a family stays together or not, whether a state gets reimbursed for doing investing in kinship care. I mean, that's another thing that you can say is, I believe some money in Title E can go to kinship care, but you can push at a federal level to demand more money go to kinship care from Title E, i.e. like the Black Extended Family Network as an alternative to interracial adoption. Similarly, Title B, a lot of that Title B money for preventative family protection services, family, keeping families together, that's going to like lawyers to go to court when people have termination hearings to their parental rights. And lawyers are cool. I'd much rather have preventative care be defined as something where you're actually investing in people's capacity to take care of their kids. Because I'm not trying to make Title B a full employment program for lawyers.
Exactly.
Because unfortunately, our Democratic Party is chock full of lawyers who think that is the solution to everything. Because you can win your parental rights, but if you still can't feed that child, if you don't have a system of conflict resolution between, you know, your baby mama, your baby daddy, or your community, you're still putting that child at risk of having a very tumultuous life. So beyond legal support, Title B should be expanded to go beyond legal support to actually foster care networks within communities to go upstream to prevent the root causes of people needing to get their go to family court and dealing with child parental right termination in the first place. So these are some of the technocratic legal machinations that I think are really, really important for us to understand what is going on here. Because one of the last things I wanted to say is I think this is actually one of the issues that could most effectively create a cross-class, cross-race political alliance.
Say more.
Like, look at, if you study QAnon at all, some of the people who got most into QAnon, their brains broke after their kids got taken away. So there's this feeling, they're like, why you want my kid? It's like, what you gonna do, abuse him? You know, for this whole like obsession with child abuse, a lot of it comes from people getting their kids taken away and this fear that like there is this system that is hurting kids. And there is a system hurting kids. It's just not run by reptiles. It's not run by an evil cabal. It's the family regulation system run by good Democrats.
Is there a large number of QAnon supporters who had their children?
Well, the ones who turned to violence, a lot of the ones who got most extreme and turned to like vigilantism and violence, a lot of them had their kids taken away. But there is a huge concern about how do we protect the children from the state. And that gets seen within the conspiratorial frame. But it's not a conspiracy to say there's a multi-billion dollar industry that is less interested in actually protecting children, as we've seen, with operationalizing forms of social control through the lens of child welfare. And if you actually gave people a coherent argument that sort of explained to them the class and race roots of this system and really making the argument that what starts with Black people and Natives, it's going to impact white people eventually.
Yeah.
And that's an argument that many people have made, and I think this is really being borne out in, like, real fruit with the child welfare system. Because think about the opioid epidemic. Because now opioids are a public health problem.
Right.
But if you're on methadone, if you're smoking medicinal weed, if you're doing any of these things, you as a white person can enter into that child welfare surveillance system. And one of the reasons why I think it's hard for people to adopt this is because we just still think social services are good. We think of them, because again, mostly I think because the people that run them, they listen to NPR. They went to the same schools a lot of the people watching did. They dropped their kids off at school. They live these like largely like liberal, nonprofit, professional lives, but the systems they're operating are these vectors of deep, deep violence. And so just the last sort of two slides I want to bring up is Civita. For-profit healthcare company, not just group homes, but they also, like I said, merged with a very prominent group home entity. And look at who they give campaign donations to. The number one person they gave campaign donations to in 2016 was Elizabeth Warren. And I think Elizabeth Warren is seen as the epitome of progressivism, the epitome of the new wave of anti-austerity, whatever, whatever, and she's the top recipient of Civita campaign donations in 2016. I think that's the problem, is that it's hitting too close to home for a lot of the progressive mainstream. It's hitting too close to home for a lot of the good white liberals, the good black liberals, the good POC liberals who have sisters, aunts, cousins, brothers who operate these welfare entities, believe they're doing well, see people being abused and suffering, and think they have to do something. But all they have is the child welfare apparatus as it is, not knowing that there needs to be a political intervention into the system to build something different. Right? So again, I just think this is a good argument against the progressive mainstream. This is a good argument as to just a huge blind spot in the people who are supposed to be doing cross-class, cross-race activism. Because then you may have to actually listen to like a QAnon person who voted for Trump, which is verboten in the sort of cultural milieu of activism today. But if you actually look at what this system is doing to people, it is a prime space for political organizing. You know, it's a prime space for going to your representative and say, what's up with Title E? Most people don't even know what Title E is. It's like, I don't think this would be nearly as hard as I think people think it is, to at least get some meaningful changes to how this money flows and what you can do with it. It just might require a vision of politics that isn't the sort of top-down progressive saviorism, which is like Medicare for all now, solidarity with every entity that's ever been oppressed ever, and never do anything with anybody that's not perfectly aligned with you. If you can get beyond those things, it's like, look, Title E is taking up all the money, and they're separating kids.
Right.
Let's get some of that money for kinship care. Let's give some of the money for Title B and kick some of these lawyers out, because they're sucking up all the Title B money. That's my assumption. That's my hypothesis, is that a lot of that Title B money is going to legal services, which is basically more of the professional managerial class sucking up the money, right? So I actually give it to you, black people, poor white people, native people on the ground, connected to families who know what they need, and you actually see results.
That's a good wrap. That's a good place to wrap.
So thank you. I appreciate you sticking with this extended two-part episode of In Search of Black Power. We hope that this gives you some ideas about how to organize in your community, places where you can plug in, and some insight into a very important space for resistance, but also really a space to build community and reestablish the care in our communities that we need to continue to go in search of Black power. So thank you, and look forward to seeing you soon.
See you.